Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
So I had gone home for the summer, and at that point, my parents were living in eastern Massachusetts, north of Boston. And in fact, they were basically in Mitt Romney's stake. And we had a next-door neighbor who was an Episcopal priest. And I would go for these long, brooding walks at this point. I mean, this was, you know, I'd go for these long walks, and I would just, like, ruminate and try to, you know, how do I get out of this? What do I do with this? And I would, like, listen to Wagner on my Walkman and go for these long walks.
Cheery music.
Yeah. And so one day I'm on my way home from this walk, and I see this Episcopal priest pass me by on the sidewalk. And all of a sudden I had this thought of, it wasn't even a thought of, I want to talk to him and confess to him that I'm gay, or like ask for his advice or for his help or anything like that. The thought that came into my mind is, I want to talk to him and get to know him better. That was all that I consciously knew at that point. I want to talk to this person. So I asked my parents who it was. They told me his name. I found his phone number in a sort of community phone directory. I called him. I introduced myself to him. I said, would it be okay if I came over and talked to you? And he said, sure. And so I went over the next day, and I went over to his house. And I asked him, why did you decide to become an Episcopal priest? His name was the Reverend David A. Works. And he told me this whole story about how he'd been a Marine, he'd been a drunk, an alcoholic. He'd gotten in a fight. He landed himself in jail numerous times. After this one particular fight, he gets thrown in jail. And he said Christ appeared to him in his jail cell. And he resolved to change his life as a result of that encounter. And I remember thinking that, you know, I remember reading about Joseph Smith and knowing and loving the story of the first vision and thinking, I've just met somebody who has met Jesus Christ, somebody like Joseph Smith who's met Jesus Christ. And he was kind to me. He was kind to me. And I never breathed a word to him about what was going on for me, but he recognized that something was wrong. And so he basically hired me to work in his garden that summer. And so I was going over there every day, working in his garden. And he just became a friend to me. And that kind of helped me get my mind off of all of the anguish that I was in at that point. And just like, you know, being on my hands and knees in the dirt and like tending plants and being with green things kind of helped me. And so that allowed me to sort of put my suicide plans on hold.
And what about the fact that he was not a Mormon, that he was an Episcopalian priest?
Well, that was,
You were recognizing a strong spirituality there.
Yeah.
I mean, that
was a huge thing. That opened up some space for me that I think needed to be opened up. I don't think I really did anything with that other than to put it into a mental sort of file somewhere. But I remember thinking, this is pretty amazing. And maybe what that did is it established in my mind that you didn't have to be a Mormon to have significant dealings with God. Because it wasn't just that he'd had some kind of born-again experience. I mean, he was a witness of the living Christ.
And you believed him. You
and I absolutely
did not
believed
doubt
him.
That he had had that experience.
I absolutely believed him. I did not doubt it for one single instant. And he lived the kind of life that made you believe it. And this was a man who worked with alcoholics, and he worked with the people who were the hardest to work with and who were really, and you know, the more I got to know him, the more I knew about the kinds of sacrifices that he made for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew that this wasn't just BS. I mean, he lived the kind of life that you would expect somebody to live who's seen the living Christ. So that kind of, I just kind of put that aside. And later that summer, I went on an internship in Helsinki, Finland. There had been sort of a long stretch of time after that horrible worthiness interview with my bishop, where I just literally, I had become so depressed that I couldn't read my scriptures anymore. I couldn't pray. And he had told me, you're not allowed to take the sacrament anymore. You can't go to the temple. Right. So effectively, no spiritual practice for me anymore. And I'm going to church. I'm listening to the talks. I'm sort of going through those motions. But like, I'm home with my parents and thinking, what must they think of me that I'm letting the sacrament tray pass me by and I'm not taking the sacrament?
So you just self-imposed that ongoing restriction once you got to your home ward.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had no reason to unimpose it, right? He said, talk to me again when you've been masturbation-free for 3 months, and I certainly hadn't been that. And once you get to the point where you've just kind of given up, you know, then I was like masturbating like crazy. You know, I was just like not, I didn't care anymore. I had kind of given up, really. So I had stopped praying for quite a long time, and I was like, if somebody pushed me about it. Now, I mean, you might say this sounds kind of contradictory, because on the one hand, you know, this Episcopal priest tells me about how he's seen Jesus Christ, and this made this profound impression on me, and it did. But at the same time, I'm angry at God. I mean, I'm sort of wobbling in between these two possibilities. Either God doesn't exist, or if he does exist, he's a bastard, and I hate him because he's done this to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thought of getting down on my knees and praying is impossible to me at this point. But, you know, I mean, I guess now that I sort of reflect back and sort of think about it, and I think about the impact that this Episcopal priest had on me, you know, he, again, maybe he sort of opened up to me this possibility that, you know, because here he is, he's a drunk and he's in jail, and Jesus helped him.
So redemption seemed somehow
maybe more possible to me.
Or maybe in a different way.
Yeah.
Maybe there was
But really the crucial moment for me was shortly after I had arrived in Helsinki, Finland, and I got my apartment and I was getting all set up. I was staying.
Now repeat, what was getting you to Helsinki?
This was a summer internship that had actually been organized through the German languages department at BYU. Because I, at that point, I was like studying Finnish and wanted to sort of deepen my mastery of the language. And so that had been arranged. So I arrive in Helsinki. I'm staying in these dorms at a Finnish college there north of Helsinki in Vantaa. And I arrive in my apartment and I feel the Holy Spirit very powerfully. And basically, I felt the Spirit inviting me to pray. And immediately I'm having an argument with the Spirit. I'm saying, I don't even know how to do that anymore. But again, I'm feeling this invitation, like, just get down on your knees. Just open up your heart. That's all you need to do. And so I get down on my knees, and I start to pray. And the entire time I'm feeling the spirit more and more powerfully. And I'm just weeping. And, you know, I don't remember the exact words of my prayer, but it was something along the lines of, you know, I basically said, okay, God, I'm going to be real with you. I am gay. And there was just like this overwhelming, I just felt enveloped by love. And I had a very clear message that came to me from God saying, I know that about you because I know how you are made from your inmost parts. Those words came to me. And basically the message was, I had nothing to be ashamed of. I had nothing to be afraid of. That I was not condemned. And that God knew about this part of me, that he accepted it, that it was good. These were all things that were made very clear to me in that moment. And all of a sudden, it was like this light had been turned on in my life. Like all of a sudden, I was like happy about church. And I was happy about... But I was also... It's interesting because I was open now to exploring other religions too. And I had a friend at the place where I was working as part of this internship. And we would talk about religion, and he had all kinds of questions for me about being a Mormon and about Joseph Smith. Yeah.
Can I just come back, though, to the...
Yeah.
There, it was sort of an epiphany, though.
Yeah.
And I just want to highlight that because it's... I keep hearing that from different people when they're telling their stories, that when they really ask God, and that's such a Mormon thing to do, to really ask God... And when you really ask him and when you're ready with an open heart to receive an answer, it's sort of like Moroni's promise.
Yeah.
But it's the gay version, which is that God is going to answer with love. And Carolyn Pearson talks about this in her new book about the hero's journey.
Yeah.
And this is really, in her mind, one of the steps that isn't just available, but is almost universal to those who really open themselves to it. But there's a big problem is that there's so much negative messages that some people just can't remove them enough to hear that voice from God that they really are loved.
Yeah.
And that's, so I just wanted to highlight that because you mentioned that experience and...
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things that I could say about it. One is that up until that moment... It never would have made sense to me to even ask God about that. Because I think up until that moment, my assumption was, of course this is wrong. Of course this is something that I should try to overcome, that it's something that should not be a part of who I am. And so up until that moment, it never would have occurred to me to kneel down and ask God, hey, is this homosexual thing okay? Never would have occurred to me. And it was only when I was literally at the end of my rope and sort of like beyond despair and where the Spirit is essentially commanding me to pray. And so where I'm saying, okay, if I'm going to pray to you, God, I have to be real. And it was in that moment that I got this incredible message back from God. And it's really interesting to me because, you know, this new research that John DeLynn and Bill Bradshaw have published, you know, one of the things that fascinated me about those findings is, you know, that question, because they asked people, have you sought guidance from God about this issue? And if so, what has God told you? And that 47% of the 1,600 or so people that they polled indicated that they had some kind of spiritual experience in which God had affirmed them as being gay and sort of affirmed their gayness as a good thing. So that number astonished me when I heard it. I was like, there's at least 750 other people out there who have had that same experience. In one study, right. Because at the time, I remembered that being a completely mind-blowing, astonishing thing. Yeah. Like, I thought, I must be the only person in the world that God has ever told something like this. And I remember even at the time thinking, how would I even tell somebody about this experience that I've had, because they just won't believe me. They'll just think that it's the product of wishful thinking, or it's some kind of, it's not a legitimate.
It's sort of the Mormon paradox, because the Mormon paradox is this: you need to pray to get your answer, but the answer has to be this answer. And if the answer isn't this answer, then you're not, you're either sinning or not faithful enough, or you're looking at pornography or something. But really, the honest thing is you have to ask a question being open to any answer, or else God can't answer it.
Right.
And that's relevant to any aspect of a testimony, but certainly this is relevant here.
I think it's in terms of where do I go with that theologically, because I understand that, like, that's where a lot of Mormons are going to go. They're going to say, oh, well, God told you this, so you must obviously be getting this from a different source than God, because God couldn't possibly tell you this, right? This is the reaction that you'd get from a lot of people. And I've wrestled with that. I'm like, well, is it possible that now I'm going to say that there is a particular kind of spiritual experience, and this was one of those where it's hard for me to imagine this being some kind of a satanic deception, for example, if that's your paradigm for evaluating a revelation of that nature. Because when you are experiencing such an influx of light and peace and love, and you're experiencing this in a way, and it's not like I was going to God and saying, you know, will you please give your stamp of approval to my homosexuality? I saw this as like a weakness that I'm exposing to God, that I'm confessing to God. And so it's not like I was expecting God to say, this is okay, I know this about you, this is okay, this is a good part of who you are. I didn't come with that expectation. But still, you know, I've kind of wrestled with it theologically, like, how do you make sense of that? And really, ultimately, every spiritual experience that you have has to be validated in some way.
Right. Well, we're taught that.
Yeah.
I mean, our initial testimony has to come that way.
Right.
And if this isn't valid, then there's nothing about a testimony that is valid.
Right.
Because this is what we're absolutely taught to depend on is the burning in the bosom, or clarity of thought, or the other ways that a spiritual confirmation is described. So if they come at you and say, well, you can't trust that,
right,
then,
well, what there
part
is
of
that
testimony
problem.
Can you trust? Because now they're just saying, well, trust us. But
right. Well, there is that problem. Like, if I can't trust this spiritual experience, then how do I trust the spiritual experience, the very similar spiritual experience that I had as an 8-year-old confirming that the Book of Mormon is true? Right. So if you call that spiritual experience into question, yes, it does kind of call into question the whole fabric of my spiritual life. But what I'm willing to say is there's another validation, which is even more fundamental, and it's a very scriptural validation, which is what kind of fruit is born by this tree, right? If you plant this seed and a tree grows from it, and what fruit do you get from it? Is it good fruit? Is it bad fruit? And so this is one reason why, you know, you can have a spiritual experience, and a spiritual experience will set you in a path, but the proof of that spiritual path is in the path itself. And if 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years down the road, you're in a place where you don't want to be, then maybe that spiritual experience was sort of sending you in the wrong direction. And fortunately, at least as I understand the plan,
or you were reading the clues wrong.
Reading the clues wrong or whatever. But, you know, so this is important, because this is an this is a spiritual insight that gay people that we have access to, because if you're somebody in my situation, there's nothing you can take for granted. There's no part of my spiritual journey that I can just say, okay, now I can just rest on that. It's okay. Literally, I'm having to follow the Paul's admonition to prove all things, test all things, validate all things. You say you've had this spiritual experience. Well, where does it lead you? What fruit comes as a result of, you know, following this revelation or this inspiration that you've received? So that has had to be a part of that path. But for me at that
point... But that also separates you from a mainstream Mormon, because the mainstream Mormon is sort of, you get this one spiritual experience, that proves everything is right, it takes away all your questions, this one experience, the one burning in your bosoms, proves the church is true, the prophet is true, every scripture is true, everything that comes out of the prophet's mouth is true, the Book of Mormon is true, it all is a package.
Well,
and you're saying, no, it's not necessarily a package.
Okay, I've heard that paradigm among Mormons, but I wouldn't necessarily privilege it by saying it's mainstream. I think that there's a lot of stuff within Mormon culture that I think of as Mormon convention, but I don't think it's necessarily scripturally or theologically correct Mormonism. And I think that a thorough reading of the Book of Mormon, of the Doctrine and Covenants, of the Bible, of all of the standard works of the Church, a thorough study of, you know, what prophets have taught, would lead you to the conclusion that everything needs to be validated. Now, I was growing up in the Church of David O. McKay, and I think back in those days, you did more often hear, you know, because you can pull Brigham Young quotes where he'll say, don't take anything I tell you for granted, right?
Right.
Right? So we've had prophets who've said, no, I don't want you to hang on every word that comes out of my mouth. I want you to test everything I teach you. And that's like the opposite of what somebody says. Like, if I prayed and had a testimony that Joseph Smith is a prophet, therefore I must accept that Brigham Young was a prophet. Therefore I must accept that Thomas S. Monson is a prophet. Therefore I must accept, right? Well, what you've done is you've built a house of cards or dominoes for yourself. Right, and so if that one card falls, then the whole frickin' thing falls apart.
Right.
Right. So I wouldn't privilege that by saying it's, whether it's statistically the norm among Mormons to look at their faith that way or not, is another question, but whether that's a correct understanding of LDS faith and doctrine, I might dispute that.
Yeah, it's certainly disputable that way, but it is definitively part of the Mormon experience, and
yes,
this is the way most Mormons look at it, as far as what is a confirmation experience what becomes the testimony and what makes the testimony valid.
A lot of people are gonna approach it that way, which put me in quite an awkward situation, to say the least. So anyway, I had this experience which, you know, really kind of changed my whole perspective. I mean, I went from being in this very deep, dark depression to feeling that things were going to be okay. You know, God was going to take care of me, and God understood. And I had no idea what was going to happen in terms of getting, you know, I didn't have any answers to any of those questions of, you know, what do I do about marriage? What do I do about all of this other stuff? I literally didn't know, but I felt like this is going to work out. You know, I will find an answer when I need the answer.
So for the first time in years, you felt...
I felt really at peace with myself.
And can I come back to something that's sort of relevant?
Yeah.
In the years since then, has depression been a problem for you on or off? Or was that really the only time where you really, truly...
That was the worst.
Okay.
That was the worst. I did experience a bout of depression after I had completed my graduate studies, but it was never as deep or as dangerous as that.
So I just want to kind of put that out there in the perspective that it's not that you're a depressive person. It's that this conflict was really leading you to such deep despair that suicide was actually a plan for you.
Yeah.
And that helps us understand why suicide is such a problem for gay people in Mormonism. So anyway, I just wanted to highlight that.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but I think that I remember hearing people describe me generally growing up as a very good-natured person with a sense of humor and being, you know, pretty much sort of upbeat.
Okay.
I don't think, there were really kind of those two significant periods of depression in my life. But other than that, you know, not really. But,
so here you are in Finland with a major weight off your shoulders.
Yeah, major weight off my shoulders.
It's a new world. It's a new dawn.
Right. And so I have this friend we were having these conversations about religion, and he's a Lutheran, and he invites me to go to church with him at the Lutheran Church, at the International Evangelical Lutheran Church in Helsinki. It's the place where they were housed at the time is called the Kalliokirkko, the Rock Church. It's actually kind of a landmark in Helsinki.
Uh-huh.
It's a really beautiful church. And I went to worship with him, and I had a very profound spiritual experience there. And it was during the absolution, the confession and absolution prior to the Eucharist, and we're reading out of the Lutheran Book of Worship, and basically there's sort of this part where you confess your sins before God, and then you are reminded of the grace of God. And I remember just that having a particularly powerful personal resonance for me, because here I had up to that point felt so worthless and so unworthy and like an utter sinner. And that sense of myself had certainly been validated by my bishop's discipline of me. And then I had this powerful spiritual experience, and now I was hearing the priest, the Lutheran priest, is echoing this personal experience that I had and saying, God loves you and forgives you all your sins. And so I just wept and wept during the service. And I remember when it came time for the Eucharist, my friend turned to me and he said, you can't take the Eucharist because you're not a Christian. Because being a Mormon, in his mind, meant I was not a Christian. And so I could not partake of the Eucharist. And so here for months, I had not been able to take the sacrament. And so in a way that was not surprising to me, somebody telling me you can't take this. But
same story, new place.
But here I was, though, and I had this new sense of, you know what, but God doesn't view me that way. And so there was this kind of jarring disconnect between my sense of how God saw me and how I was being treated by this Lutheran friend, or, you know, how I had been treated by my bishop. And so I started to wrestle, and I was like, okay, I was aware that there were certain things, certain issues that I needed to address and come to terms with. And one of them was, like, okay, how do I deal with the whole BYU thing? And at that point, I'm like very conscious that, BYU is not a healthy environment for me. I was very unhealthy. I was severely depressed there. And I remember thinking, am I setting myself up for depression and suicide if I go back into that environment? And so I was starting to think, is it healthy for me to go back to BYU? And then I was kind of like, how do I deal with this whole church worthiness thing? And how do I deal with being gay in the church? Right? I mean, all of these questions are now explicitly coming to the surface, and I'm wrestling with them for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I've come out to God. Right? And so finally, I'm like, I need to figure out what to do. And so I began to fast and pray. And it literally, it was just very open-ended. I was going to pray to God and ask God, like, what do I do? How do I move forward? Like, literally, I don't know, should I go back to BYU? Should I still be trying to find someone to marry me? So I'm fasting and praying, and I'm kneeling in prayer. And this is a day or two after I had had this very moving spiritual experience at this Lutheran church. And the Spirit is saying to me very clearly, you need to distance yourself from the church for a time. And I was kind of stunned at that. Again, this really came as a shock to me. I was kind of like, how can the Spirit be telling me to do this? And I had a kind of mental image that came to me of being in a harbor and getting into a ship, maybe kind of like Lehi's ship, and sailing away. The sense that I had of what the Lord was saying to me is, my Spirit will be with you, my Spirit is going to guide you and bring you home eventually, but I need you to do this for the time being. And so now I'm really struggling. And with that, that revelation is more clear to me than ever that going back to BYU is not an option. And then I was like, I guess I'm going to have to resign from the church. And so I'm like, how do I even do this? So it took me a couple of days to process this. And finally, I decided I need to write a letter to my parents. And so I sit down at the desk in my little dormitory apartment, pull out a piece of paper, and I think, okay, I'm going to pray and I'm going to ask the Lord to help me write this letter. What should I say to my parents? And I begin to pray, and literally I had this kind of out-of-body experience, unlike any experience that I've ever had, where literally it felt like my spirit was like ascending up through the roof of my head. And like I was being carried up, up, up. And the next thing that I was aware of after sort of passing through this light is that I'm in heaven. And the throne of God is right over there. But there's like this blinding light. And I can see the bottom of the throne. I can't see God himself in the light. But I see the light. I see the throne. And there is this host of people dressed in white standing before the throne of God. And I start looking at the faces of these people. And they are ancestors of mine that I recognize from pictures in genealogy books. And the Spirit speaks to me very clearly and says, don't worry about this. You're going to be taken care of. Just do what we've asked you to do and you'll be taken care of. And that was sort of the end of the vision. I literally actually came to, my face was like, you know, leaning on the, like lying on the desk face down, when I sort of came to out of this experience. And I immediately sat up. I took the pen. The letter to my parents just flowed out of me. I just wrote this letter to them. I talked about what I had been going through. I told them that I thought I was homosexual. That was the term that I used in the letter, because I didn't really have better language than that to talk about it. Gay didn't make sense to me at that point. And I told them that I was resigning from the church. And then this thing occurred to me, because having been branch president in Béziers in France and having read the handbook of instructions, one concern that I had is, you know, growing up in the church, I remember sort of being on the other side, you know, my dad had been a stake missionary and a ward missionary, and I'd seen him dealing with situations where people had written letters asking to resign from the church, and where the bishop had essentially not accepted their resignations, and where, you know, people were going back to them and trying to visit them and maybe even trying to talk them into staying with the church. And so I remember having seen that from the other side, and I remember thinking, I don't want this to happen to me. And I remember reading in the Handbook of Instructions that if somebody presented a baptismal certificate from another denomination showing that they had been baptized into another church, then you were obligated to remove their name from the records of the church.
Okay.
So I thought I had this ingenious method, and so of resigning from the church. And at the same time, it sort of made a sense to me because I now knew that God existed, and I absolutely believed in God and believed in Jesus Christ, and I considered myself a Christian. And so I didn't want to be outside of any kind of Christian communion, and so I thought, why don't I be baptized in the Lutheran Church? And then I can send my baptismal certificate to my bishop, and that will sever my ties with the LDS Church, and I will still have some kind of faithful connection. So that's ultimately what I did, and I shared my plan with this friend of mine, and he said, well, let me introduce you to the pastor, or the assistant pastor at the International Evangelical Church, and he did that, and I essentially went through the Lutheran Catechism with this pastor, and then ultimately I was baptized. Then they asked me, they said, how would you prefer to be baptized? Do you prefer immersion or sprinkling? And I said, I prefer immersion.
So they actually,
that's what I believe in.
They actually had that available.
Well, I was baptized in the Baltic Sea.
Okay.
It was cold.
At least it was August.
Right. It was August. And, you know, had this wonderful experience with that. And it was a beautiful experience. And it did feel kind of like a rebirth to me, you know, because I had gone through just this incredible darkness and depression. And
really did pain. Symbolize a new start for you.
It really did. And this baptism took place as part of a church retreat. You know, so interestingly enough, there was this guy at the retreat that I had a crush on, developed a crush on very quickly. And I sensed that he had sort of reciprocal feelings about me. And so it was just kind of this, it was this interesting situation where I was no longer feeling stressed about that or in the same kind of anguish. And there was a point where this friend actually invited me over to his home, and where he dropped some very sort of clear hints that he would accept like physical advances from me. And I remember at that point feeling like, I'm not ready for this yet. I haven't figured all that stuff out yet.
Uh-huh.
But I remember thinking, I remember feeling there's nothing wrong with me, there's nothing wrong with him. I recognized this kind of beauty in the feelings that I was experiencing, and I just wasn't experiencing the kind of anguish that I had experienced about that. So now I was really happy about the possibility of exploring the fact that God is at work in many churches and in many places, and now I was kind of free to explore that and learn more about that. And so as time went on, I went to Pentecostal churches, I went to Baptist churches, I went to African-American Baptist churches, which is a very different experience from white Baptist.
So this was your promiscuity stage.
Yeah, my religious promiscuity. Yes. When I was visiting my parents in Massachusetts, I would go to the Episcopal Church where this priest who had had such an important impact on me and had basically saved my life.
Yeah.
I went to the church and worshipped there with him, and so I was sort of exploring spiritually, and it was a great expansive time for me, and it really kind of opened me up to a lot of things. And after I finished my undergraduate degree, so I left BYU, I went to Northern Michigan University because there was this Lutheran connection, and there were people in Helsinki who were able to connect me with folks in Upper Michigan who could help me get situated, because I was having to do this really quickly. Like, end of August, I'm, like,
right.
quitting BYU.
School
I'm trying to get
starts
into...
in a week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Literally, it was, like, 2 weeks. You know, I had to figure all of this stuff out. And I made it all happen. I go to Northern Michigan University, and so I'm kind of figuring this all out. And it's a really positive thing. And I remember the summer before all of this had happened, I remember reading Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. And I remember thinking it was a wonderful, wonderful thing to be a mere Christian. To just claim that.
Right.
Like, to be a disciple of Jesus Christ and to let go of all of these arbitrary divisions between all of these different denominations and sects and churches, and not condemning anybody's way of worshiping or viewing anything, just kind of being open to learning about it. So this was a wonderful time. But it was very difficult with my parents. About a week after I sent that letter off to my dad and my mom, and that letter went out simultaneously with a letter that, well, I think I... No, it couldn't have gone out simultaneously because the letter to my bishop had a copy of the baptismal certificate. So it was sometime later that I sent a letter to my bishop. But I had sent this letter to my parents, and my dad and mom, literally as soon as they got the letter, they called me, like long distance, which at that time was really expensive to do.
Right, it was a big event.
It was a big event. You almost never did that. And they called me, and they begged and pleaded with me, and they were confused more than anything else because I had never breathed a word to them of anything that I was going through. So from their perspective, their straight A, Kimball scholar, return missionary, true blue, had always been like this super devoted Mormon my whole life, and especially, you know, from the time I was a teenager on. And literally, in their eyes, and probably in the eyes of a lot of the people that I grew up with in my home ward, I literally walked on water.
Yeah.
And so to have gone from that to all of a sudden saying, I'm homosexual and I'm leaving the church. And my mother literally, at one point, she was like, she said, I'm afraid that you've been possessed by Satan. And for them, I mean, it was literally that shocking. Like, they
right.
just, it was impossible for them to imagine how I could have just made, like, what felt to them like a 180-degree turn about, you know.
Which it was, but they didn't have still
they didn't
background.
Have, they didn't have the context. And you know, I remember trying to explain to them and saying, look, I feel close to my Heavenly Father. I know that I'm not turning against God. And I remember, you know, saying to them, I said, I expect to see you in the celestial kingdom. And I remember them saying to me, we don't expect to see you in the celestial kingdom. And that was, you know, really painful.
Yeah, that's sad.
For me. So we literally kind of went through this like 3-year length of time where I wasn't really communicating with my family because what was most...
So that put a schism, really.
It did. Oh, it put a schism.
You needed to explore without that sort of over your head.
Yeah. And it was painful for me because the church was literally the only thing that I had in common with my dad. Like, I was never interested in sports. I was never interested in, like, all of the other kinds of secular pursuits that he thought were fun and cool. And my brother Mark, I think, had more in common with Dad in terms of, you know, some of the interests they had. But for me, literally, the church was the only thing I'd had in common with my dad. But the church was so central to everything I was and everything in my life, that was enough to
yeah.
for, like, huge common ground with my dad. But when that was taken out of the picture, I mean, it just, it was, you know, there were times, like, I remember when I had come home from Finland, I was on my way to Northern Michigan, and I was sort of at home, at my parents' home in Massachusetts for a couple of days, and, like, literally my dad just, he would get so angry that he would get up and walk out of the room, and he couldn't even be in the same room with me. It was just so painful. And that was the point where I stopped going home for the summer in between semesters. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to go home for this brief period around Christmas. But, you know, pretty much I had to kind of cut ties. And literally there was a period where, apart from just very superficial conversations, like maybe once or twice a year, I literally wasn't talking with my parents. And in grad school is really where I was starting to come to terms with the whole gay thing.
So you finished college, you got your degree, you salvaged your undergrad.
Yep.
And
at Northern Michigan, and I took this insane schedule in order to meet all of their requirements, and I was able to transfer a lot of my credits from BYU, but they didn't accept any of my religion credits.
So anyway, you had this newfound energy because you weren't hating yourself.
Right.
I mean, you weren't necessarily exploring your gay side yet, but you had a lot to do just to get your undergrad degree. So
that's
really
correct.
Were able to focus on it and and just have a productive year that really prepared you to do your next steps. So.
Yeah, exactly. So I finished the undergrad, and then I decided to make immigration studies my field in grad school, and that's what brought me to the University of Minnesota, because they had the biggest immigration archives in the country, and they had a really good social history program, and I thought, okay, this will be kind of cool.
So you applied to the University of Minnesota to a PhD program?
I had to apply to a master's program, although at first you had to get your master's and then you could get your PhD, and I got accepted into the PhD program. And then they changed the requirements the first year, so I was able to just skip the master's and just go straight into the PhD. But
anyway, you moved to Minneapolis.
I moved to Minneapolis. Okay, so, you know, grad school basically was where I was able to start really exploring what it meant to be gay in a serious way. And again, there was a particular experience that I'd had that sort of triggered a kind of moment of crisis for me with this, where I really had to kind of figure things out. So now I'm officially a member of the Lutheran Church. I'm attending, I'm participating in these Lutheran campus ministry activities at the University of Minnesota. It's a very gay-friendly, sort of gay-sensitive environment. They're actually talking about homosexuality as an issue
Within the Lutheran community.
Within the Lutheran community, and there's a very gay positive perspective, sort of the typical liberal Protestant, more affirming perspective on homosexuality that's really kind of embraced by the staff at the Lutheran campus ministry and by the students who are involved. And so I'm listening to these conversations, and but I'm kind of really the only people that I've come out to this at this point are God and my parents in this letter that I wrote them. And nobody else have I ever really spoken to about this. And at the University of Minnesota, there's a very strong, active gay community. There's an organization called UGC, University Gay Community. They have dances, they have events. I'm way too terrified to even think about getting involved in any of that. But I am listening to what people are saying in Lutheran campus ministry. And there comes a point where I'm sitting, there's like a student lounge, and I would frequently go there between classes and would be sort of doing homework while I'm waiting for my next class. And sometimes other students would be hanging out there and kind of chatting. And I'm sitting at the table, and there's like a few other people sitting at the table, and this woman is reading Dear Abby. And she's reading this letter to Dear Abby from this guy who says, okay, I have been married for 10 years. I have three children. I am basically sort of a pillar of my church community. I have a very responsible job as an executive and blah, blah, blah. And I'm a homosexual, and my marriage has been a shambles for the last 7 years. And, you know, I haven't had sex with my wife and for years, and everything is falling apart. And what should I do? You know, should I keep living this lie, or do I, like, leave my wife? What do I do? That was the question to Dear Abby. And I think Dear Abby says something to the effect of, you know, to thine own self be true. You know, you're not doing anybody a service by, you know, continuing to live a lie this way. You really need to figure out what you want in life and so on. It wasn't Dear Abby's response that got me so much as the question itself, because I remember thinking that could be me in 10 years. And I really need to make a decision and figure out what do I do with this. And so this is my first year in grad school. And so I decide that I'm going on a spiritual quest. And I decided that I was going to fast. And I was not going to stop fasting until I had gotten a satisfactory answer from God. And I had a very specific question that I put to God. And my question was, do I remain open to the possibility of marrying a woman, or do I commit myself to a life of celibacy? Those were the two choices in my mind.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I presented to God. And at that point, I had sort of been, there was a woman that I knew who, a fellow student who I had met through Lutheran Campus Ministry. And she seemed to really like me, and so...
So even though you had accepted being gay and accepted that God loved you...
Right.
It still didn't give yourself permission to actually pursue that part of your life.
I really wasn't ready for that. And so I had actually gone on a few dates with this woman. And ironically, one of the women that I had dated at BYU was living here in the Twin Cities. And so I actually went on a number of dates with her as well, which was actually kind of a good thing because it was kind of helping me process how I was feeling about the church too. And she was still committed to the church. And so we were having some conversations about that too. But, you know, it really was also just a way for me to figure out, you know, what do I do in terms of these relationships? And so anyway, I thought, okay, I can't just marry a woman because it's the sort of default plan. And I had always envisioned myself as a father and being married and having children. And so it was really hard for me to imagine like a life without that, because that was always what I had envisioned for myself. But I thought, okay, I need an answer from God. And so I began this fast, and I had even sort of established some rules. I was like, okay, I'm fasting until I get an answer from God. It might take more than 24 hours. And I said, okay, no food or water the first 24 hours. And then after the first 24 hours, I'll take water, but I'm not going to eat until God has answered my prayer. And so that's kind of how it went. And I began this fast. I opened my fast with a prayer. I said, God, this is what I need to know. Should I be celibate or should I try to marry a woman? And the answer came to me on the third day of my fast. So I'd been going without food for quite a while at this point. And I was literally on the midpoint of the bridge. I don't know if you know the University of Minnesota campus, but there's this footbridge that goes between the East Bank and the West Bank.
Over the Mississippi River.
Over the Mississippi River. And, you know, there's like a highway underneath it, but then there's a footbridge, you know, sort of above it. And so I was walking across that footbridge, and I was just, you know, had been really wrestling with this the whole time, sort of thinking, okay, you know, but I wanted this to come from God. I wanted this to be an answer that I got from God, not just something that I came up with on my own. And I kind of felt like I sort of understood what was going on for me. I had been, you know, continuing to date women. And so I kind of felt like I'd done my homework and I deserved an answer from God. And it was on the midway point, in the middle of that footbridge, that the answer came to me. And literally the Spirit said to me, be open to all possibilities. That was the answer.
Other. Not A, not B, but other.
Right. That was how I understood it.
Yeah.
How I understood it was there are options that you haven't considered, and you need to be open to them. And the timing was very interesting. So I had gotten that answer, and I thought, okay, this is a little bit confusing. It's not, it doesn't get really give me a clear direction as to what I'm supposed to do, apart from maybe go back and try to fit, you know, try to figure more out. But I was satisfied enough that I was able to break my fast, and it turned out that that evening I had signed up to go on this like weekend men's retreat through the Lutheran Campus Ministry. And it just so happened that two of the individuals who were part of this men's retreat were openly gay men. And this was the first time that I had ever met them. And this was the first time that I had ever met a gay man who was openly gay. And this happened on the same day that this revelation came to me.
Okay.
And both of these men were dating other men. And so I kind of got the picture. I was like, oh, they're exploring an option that I have not put on the table. And the Spirit has told me that I need to explore all the options. So that was the point where I said, okay, I now actually have three choices: heterosexual marriage, celibacy, same-sex partnership. So I said, okay, I'm going to obey the promptings of the Spirit. I'm going to put that on the table. But that didn't mean I had ruled the first two options out. I was literally doing what the Spirit had asked me to. I was considering all my options.
Right.
It didn't mean that I had decided to enter a same-sex relationship. So I did, shortly thereafter, I did pretty much rule out option A. And that felt right to me. And that was, again, something that prayerfully, the more I thought about it, the more I realized I'm just leading these women that I'm dating on, and I'm not doing them any kind of justice, and I will not be a good husband to them. And I was very conscious about it. I remember sort of scheduling the last date that I'm ever going to have with this person and sitting down with them and saying, you know, and interestingly enough, one of these women, the woman that I had been dating through Lutheran Campus Ministry, after that experience with these two gay men at the gay men's retreat, shortly thereafter I came out to everybody that I was associated with at Lutheran Campus Ministry. In fact, I went to both of the Lutheran Campus ministers and I told them, I said, I'm gay.
Okay.
So now I'm starting to come out publicly as a result of this spiritual experience. So I told the ministers and they said, would you be open to sharing this with the group? And I said, I very much would.
So they were affirming.
They were very affirming.
Yeah.
And they said, we think that our community can be very supportive of you. And if you want to come out to the group, you can. And I said, I would like to do that. And so I came out to the group, and this woman whom I had been dating was part of that group.
Okay. Did you hear that way then, or did you tell her prior?
You know, I honestly can't remember if I told her prior, but the reason I mention it is because there was this moment where, like, after I had come out to the group, she and I went on a date.
Okay.
So now she knows.
Yeah.
She knows that I'm gay. We've been dating for a while. And we even had the conversation. You know, she was like, well, would you ever consider, do you see a relationship with me as a possibility? And so we actually kind of talked about it. And I remember it was difficult for her, because I sensed that she really liked me a lot. I think she was disappointed that I had come out, but ultimately, you know, I told her pretty much in almost the same words that I've just told you. You know, I said, I really don't think that it would be fair to you. I don't think I could do you justice as a life partner, as a husband. We ended amicably. You know, we ended that dating relationship amicably, and she, I think, continued to be very personally supportive of me, and she started dating a couple of other guys, one of whom really treated her like an asshole and was terrible and, you know, kind of slept with her and then dumped her or whatever. And
yeah.
So I remember thinking that was horrible, and how could straight men do that? Bad. Shame on you. And then there was this woman who was still active in the church and whom I had dated at BYU, and we sort of went on a final date, and it was deeply upsetting to her when I came out to her at this date. And in fact, we had gone out to dinner at a fairly upscale restaurant in St. Paul, and I came out to her before the food was brought out, and she basically just wanted to end it. Like, this was the end of the date. We weren't even going to stay for dinner. We were just going to, like, go home and end it. So we ended it, and that was really hard for me. I wanted to be friends with this person. I had always dated her because she was the kind of person I wanted to be friends with.
Right.
And after I came out to her, I would call her, we'd talk on the phone, but then there came this moment where she said, I don't feel that my standards allow me to continue my friendship with you, which hurt me. But I was kind of like, okay, if that's the way it has to be, that's the way it has to be. I kind of felt like I had pursued that mixed orientation marriage option as far as it was going to take me, and I realized that was, so I scratched that off my list. So I had two possibilities left. So I thought, okay, if I was going to live a life of celibacy, how could I do it? And I was actively thinking about it, like, what would I do? What kind of life would I create for myself? How would that work? And one of the things that I realized is that I couldn't just live alone.
Yeah.
So I'm exploring different religious options at this point in my life. As I said, I'm, like, going to all these different churches. And I thought, what about becoming, you know, joining a Roman Catholic monastic order? What if I did that? There you have the community, you have the friendship, you have this sort of intense bonds with other people that you're closely connected to in community. And I thought, that might be kind of cool. And so there was this guy that had been an investigator of mine in France named Jean-Marie. And he was one of our most serious investigators, and we had taught him for a very long time. And he had come to church with us on the condition that we would go to church with him, because he was a very devout Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember going with him to his church, and I remember him sort of explaining the iconography and kind of talking about their beliefs about Christ. And so I had this very close, intense connection with Jean-Marie and had continued to correspond with him after my mission. And when I was in my sophomore year at BYU, I got a letter from him saying that he was joining this monastic order in central France called the Brothers of St. John. It was sort of an offshoot from the Dominican order.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote him a letter and I said, would it be okay if I came and spent a summer with you at the monastery, because I would really like to explore living monastically.
So this was about a year into your graduate studies.
Right, right. And he wrote me back and he said, I've spoken with the head of my order, and he said that as long as you were willing to follow all the rules and live like the rest of the monks and do everything that they're doing, you're welcome to live there as long as you want and explore this. And I wrote him back and I said, I wouldn't have it any other way. I want to do that. So at the end of that first year in grad school, during that summer between my first year in grad school and my second year in grad school, I'm at a monastery in central France near Le Creusot. It's actually within the mission boundaries of the Swiss Geneva mission.
But not the branch president.
Right. And it was an amazing experience. You know, I was getting up at the crack of dawn, like literally as the sun is rising, and I'm going to Vespers, and I'm praying. I'm in prayer and meditation like 4 hours a day. I'm working on this potato farm with the other monks. We're doing a study of the Book of Isaiah with a former Dominican who is a converted Jew, who's teaching us from a Hebrew
perspective.
Tanakh, uh-huh. Right? he's reading it to us in Hebrew, and then he's giving us an extemporaneous translation, and that's how we're studying Isaiah. And I had been given free, you know, it was very much a contemplative order. So the normal rule for the monks was to keep silence. They ate a vegetarian diet except for Sunday. They had one meal with meat that was accompanied by a glass of wine and a piece of chocolate for dessert. And I loved everything about that lifestyle. I loved it. And I loved the contemplativeness. I loved the long, long hours of silence. Well, at first, the silence was starting to drive me bonkers, like literally bonkers.
Uh-huh.
For about the first week that I was there, I thought I was going to go stir crazy. But then there came this moment, like after that first week, where I'd get up for Vespers and I'd go into the chapel and I'd kneel down on this cold stone floor with like this really rough mat. And I'm kneeling on this thing and just meditating. And it was just like this peace, just wonderful peace, wonderful peacefulness. And once I kind of got into that like frame of just this incredible peacefulness, I loved the beauty of what these brothers had created there. And there was just this...
But a question about that. So do they have a time of day where they can freely talk, or can they invite each other to each other's rooms and have these intense conversations, or are they pretty much...
There are times...
Hardly ever talking to anybody.
There are times when they're allowed to talk, but they're circumscribed. And normally you wouldn't talk. You would just work together. When you were in class, you could ask questions and you could have sort of open discussion that way.
But what about getting together?
Yeah.
Could you invite somebody to your room and have a discussion? Was this kind of bonding going on, or was it really solitary?
I think my sense was that it was more solitary. Your bonding was taking place through the various activities that you're engaged in. Because you're working with people, you're eating with people, you're studying with people, but I didn't get a sense that there was like a lot of one-on-one time where you'd invite somebody to your cell and have a conversation with them. And in fact, what I was told, though, is I said, because you're new here, this is what they told me. I said, because you're new here and because you're exploring, we want you to feel free to ask anybody any questions that you want. And we've told all of the brothers that if you approach them, if you ask them questions, if you want to talk to them, they have leave to share freely with you and talk to you and so on.
Okay.
So I was granted that permission. But, you know, the thing is, there was a kind of intimacy in that life that I loved. Like, when they would greet each other in the service, and... Those who are listening to the podcast can't see this, but, you know, they would put their hands on their shoulder and then they would just, like, touch their foreheads like this. And it was the sweetest thing. And it was physically intimate. It was kind of like a beautiful gesture. And there was just something about it that I thought, if I were to live the rest of my life in celibacy, this is how I could do it. Surrounded by these beautiful men who are totally committed to God and for whom that commitment is transcendent, but being able to share with them in that community. To me, that there was something just really beautiful and exciting about that. And so I thought, if I were to do this, this is how I would do it. But the question was not, could I do this, but should I do it? And so the beautiful thing about this time at the monastery was that I had more than enough time to meditate, to pray, to think, to sort of interrogate God. And I was talking to the brothers. I was getting as much information as I could.
Yeah.
And every
in
chance...
In French, all of this was...
All in French.
Yeah.
And every chance that I had, I would like take somebody aside and I'd say, okay, so tell me about celibacy. What does this mean to you? Like, why did you make this choice? Why would you choose to do this as opposed to getting married, having a family, and so on? So there were a whole bunch of different perspectives that I heard from this. And I talked to everybody from the head of the order to my friend who had been my former investigator, investigating the LDS Church, to other brothers that I met there for the first time. And so everybody sort of had their take on it. But the one consistent message that I kept getting from everybody was, you have to feel called to this. And they said, if there's even an ounce of you're doing this because you're trying to run away from your sexuality, it won't work. Mm-hmm. You will fail. You need to do this because this is what you feel called to do. And they would even talk about the gift of celibacy. Like this was almost kind of like a spiritual gift that you could have that not everybody had. And that helped me, because then what that said to me is, okay, I have to discern whether this is a gift that I have and whether this is a calling that I have. And so that gave me some focus, and it helped sort of sharpen the interrogation process with God. And ultimately, I came to the determination that this was not a gift or a calling for me.
So did you get the sense that a lot of them would have been gay had they not been monks, or?
That was a very conscious question I had in my mind, although I certainly was not going to put anybody in the awkward situation of asking them if they were gay. It occurred to me very naturally that many of them probably were. But it helped me to hear people talk about how they were aware of the fact that you can't be running away from your sexuality. And so even if they were gay, what they were telling me is, this isn't the default position for a gay person.
Right.
This isn't your only option if you're gay. This is an option if you're gay. So that really kind of helped me get some clarity. And ultimately, there was not any one like really dramatic spiritual experience that I had. It was just kind of like by the end of my stay there, I had clarity. I knew that this was not what I was called to do. And I remember going for a walk with my friend, like shortly before I left the monastery. And he said to me, you know, did you find an answer to your question? And I said, yes, I have. I am not called to this. Mm-hmm. And he smiled and he said, I feel the same way. He said that just based on what I know of you, and he said, what I knew of you as a missionary, what I know of you now as a person, and he said to me, tu as un appel plus apostolique. You have a more apostolic calling. Which has connotations within Mormonism that he didn't intend, but basically what he meant is, you are meant to be out in the world as sort of a messenger of God, sort of in the hustle and bustle of everyday life.
Instead of cloistered.
Right, instead of being here in a monastery. And so he kind of validated that for me. You know, he sort of said, you know, if that's the sense that you're getting, that's kind of my sense of you too. And so I felt very satisfied that I had fully explored that as an option. And so I came home from France back to Minneapolis with a very clear sense, okay, now I'm going to explore gay relationships.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see this podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation, again at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. Music for this podcast was graciously donated by Clayton Pixton. Check him out at claytonpixton.com.
Why should this anxious load press down your weary mind? Haste to your heavenly Father's throne and sweet refreshment find. His goodness stands approved, unchanged from me.